There are reportedly more retired and active duty military officers in President Donald Trump's cabinet than in any other administration since World War II. This includes the Secretaries of Defense and Homeland Security and the National Security Advisor. Now, having top military officers in the cabinet is not unusual. Throughout U.S. history, many uniformed leaders of the armed forces have taken top civilian posts. But when these military professionals enter the world of Oval Office briefings and sometimes civilian partisan politics, what challenges do they face? And how important is a balance of military and non-military perspectives in the White House in advancing U.S. defense and foreign policy interests? I'm Robert McMahon, Managing Editor of CFR.org, and you're listening to The President's Inbox, a CFR podcast that examines the foreign policy challenges facing President Donald Trump. We look at the issues topping his inbox and discuss what he has said he will do and what constraints he might face. This week, we're going to talk about civil-military affairs and how it may influence President Trump's defense and foreign policies. With us this week to help in the discussion is Janine Davidson. Janine recently served as the 32nd Undersecretary of the United States Navy during the Obama administration. Before that, she was CFR's Senior Fellow for Defense Policy. Janine is also an Air Force veteran, where she became the first woman to fly the tactical C-130 aircraft. In July, she becomes the next president of the Metropolitan State University of Denver. Janine, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here.
Well, it's been a long time since we've had so much discussion about civil-military relations in an incoming administration. So for starters, Janine, can you talk about how these relations have typically been handled in U.S. administrations?
Sure. I mean, the norm is, well, every administration is different. And like you said in your opening, there have been plenty of administrations that have had uniformed military leaders in some of these positions, active and retired. That said, the system is designed to have a mixture of perspectives, civilian and military, for a reason. The military, you know, if you serve as an admiral or a general for 35 years, you have an immense amount of knowledge about the operational elements of warfare and about organizing, training, and equipping a ginormous organization. It's not the same kind of experience and expertise that a lot of the civilians bring to the White House. You have national security experts coming from academia. You have them, people have served in other positions. And then you have a lot of political operatives. So by definition, we have civilian control in this country for a reason. And so some people are pretty uncomfortable with having lots of active and or even retired people in these positions. The Secretary of Defense, traditionally, you want somebody who can sort of be the in-between translator between those military admirals and generals who are going to bring to the White House. They're going to bring advice, military advice, to the president on use of force, you know, big decisions, you know, should we go into Syria? You know, what should we be doing about Russia and China? And ideally, the Secretary of Defense and the National Security Advisor will be the people that can translate and take that operational advice that they're getting from the military and add to the flavor the political pieces that the president needs to worry about and give the president a different sort of set of advice. And so we worry if all those same people are bringing that same lens.
So let's take the Defense Department. It's, retired General Mattis, James Mattis, is there. He actually made the big U.S. trip abroad in this administration. It was a trip to Asia, which was part of a sort of a calming mission, if you will, to U.S. allies. But also, he's been seen as more vocal and more out in front on dealing with U.S. allies and even some sort of traditional diplomatic sort of messaging, while the State Department seems to languish. And there is a Secretary of State, but there's not a lot of supporting staff there. There have been a lot of departures. And now there's even been a pretty sharp cutbacks in State Department budgeting, where you've had General Mattis's quotes about the need for a diplomatic and foreign aid aspect to the U.S. sort of collective quiver. Can you talk a little bit about what challenge this sort of circumstance poses?
Yeah, so this, what you've just described, is not necessarily a reflection of having a general as Secretary of Defense. This issue of the military being much more capable and much better resourced and much better positioned abroad is perennial. It's been happening for decades. And the State Department being traditionally underfunded. Politically, it's very easy for the military to get the resources that they need. There's, you know, something in every congressman or senator's state or jurisdiction, it's easy to say thank you for your service to the military guys. The diplomats are not as well supported in that way. And, you know, this was a huge issue during the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War, because there was a sense that the military was doing all these, quote, non-military things that they needed State Department people for. Well, the fact that the State Department isn't organized, trained, and equipped to kickstart provinces in the middle of a war zone, you know, regardless, there was a sense that there should be more civilians. And so that's a huge issue. I think that at this moment in time, it's exacerbated by the fact that the State Department is really flailing. They have had a big brain drain, a big experience drain up at the top of their sort of career civilians that have been politely asked to resign, and they've done so. And then you have Tillerson at the head without any serious appointees below him. So he's not keeping up. And so we default to the military once again, and we've been doing this for a long time. Remember, Dana Priest wrote a great book about this in the 90s called The Mission, where she's like, the face of America has become military. How did this happen?
So nothing new, and there's a quote we often hear. I think it was then Defense Secretary Gates saying there are more people in military bands than there are foreign service officers.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit more about the defense and state relationship. I mean, this has been a long time now. You've had this gigantic U.S. military budget, certainly in respect to U.S. foreign operations and foreign service. How have those two departments gotten along? How have they worked? You mentioned Afghanistan. There was an experiment there of what they called provincial reconstruction teams, where you had units of both operating in the field. Can you talk a little bit about how this relationship has worked and hasn't in recent history?
Sure. I spent a lot of time at the war colleges talking to military people about this issue. And one of their perception is that, you know, if they're going to go abroad in some of these complex operations, they're sort of in between war, not war, that there's going to be civilians and State Department people there with them. The fact of the matter is that you're right. There are more lawyers in the DOD than there are diplomats, as well as band members.
So lawyers and band members. Okay.
Oh, yeah, definitely lawyers. You know, so when Condoleezza Rice, when she was Secretary of State, set up the provincial reconstruction team idea or supported it, I remember her testifying in Congress about how, you know, they were going to have diplomats on the ground in these provinces. And within about a couple weeks, I was working in the Pentagon at the time as sort of a mid-level person, we got a request from the State Department for civilians to volunteer for those positions because the State Department literally was writing checks they could not cash. So it happens at all levels. So at the highest level with the secretaries, you know, they've got the planes, they're out, you know, engaging with their counterparts around the world, the secretaries of defense are. But then even down in sort of the lower level staffs, you know, you've got huge staffs of military officers doing strategic planning and operational planning, and they'll have these big conferences and they'll bring people together and they'll invite State Department people and USAID people and Treasury people and Commerce people, and they don't always come because they just don't A, see it as part of their job, or B, literally do not have enough hours in the day to do this kind of thing. They're just completely overwhelmed by the lack of personnel in the State Department.
How is this, so to take this a step further and looking at kind of the landscape now facing the Trump administration, and they've identified the Islamic State in particular and what some officials have said is radical Islamic terrorism as the main threat to the U.S. There is an ongoing war in Afghanistan. There's the authorization of U.S. Using military force, which continues to be seemingly open-ended, and drone strikes occurring in places like Yemen and so forth. So what does this mean in terms of how decision-making now, the calculations going on in decision-making, if you have a preponderance of, say, military officials in your top decision-making organizations and departments sort of calling the shots in this?
Sure. Well, we don't know who's calling the shots, right? But we know who's in the room, right? And this gets back to, you know, what I was saying in the beginning, which is military people, you know, have a very operational focus. What they have been taught is that, you know, that their job is to organize, train, and equip and be ready in case there's a big war. And so they scan the horizon and they think about this, and they have very complex bureaucratic processes for doing this because it's an immense budget and they spend a lot of time doing that. And what they expect is that when there's a war or a requirement to exercise military force, that they will get very clear guidance from the White House, that the president will say, I want you to do this, and this is the kind of outcome I want. they call it an end state, and this is the amount of resources I'm going to put out, and, you know, tell me how you're going to do it.
So this is for things like
a war in Syria.
Or
something small, right? And so this is what the military expects. Although that what we've learned is that it's not very realistic because it sort of requires the president to be sort of, clairvoyant, and actually already know all these technical things about, how many carriers it might take to do X or Y. And so we end up with this sort of chicken and egg problem where the military says, tell us what you want us to do. And the civilians and the president say, well, tell me what's doable. Right. And so we've evolved a little bit, but we still struggle with that a lot. So now in an ideal world, you'll have military bringing the sort of art of the doable, a set of options together. And then there'll be civilians in the room and State Department folks, too, that can bring in the political pieces. Well, that may knock the wall down, but we have a greater issue in this country or that country. What happens after that? And what about the allies? And how are we going to bring them in? And there's all kinds of other elements. So if it's just the military in the room, you're going to get a much more technical focus. That's the worry. And the last thing I'll say about that, you worry about that. But then you have generals and admirals that are, I would say, the exception that proves the rule, right? So, if you're going to – General Mattis is incredibly brilliant. I don't expect him to be very, linear and technical. I expect him to be able to do more than that.
Well, and in referring to General Mattis, or now Defense Secretary Mattis, there have been reports coming out of the last several days that President Trump may be interested in giving him a freer hand in terms of launching counterterrorism missions, like the one that was described in Yemen, the SEAL Team 6 strike that has drawn a lot of controversy, drew a lot of attention at the president's joint address to Congress, where he invoked the name of the dead SEAL and showed his wife who was attending. So in these kinds of situations, whether it could be a hostage rescue mission or taking out terrorists or whatever, there has been an argument that, for more speed, let's go with the professionals, the military professionals. You just cited some of the reasons why that might be a problem, but why might that be a better thing or a good thing?
Yeah, this has always been an issue. The military will always want more of a free hand, right? But they also want to know what the objectives are, right? And so they'll be very good at, having a list of high-value targets. And what they've been frustrated with over the past few years is they've got this list of high-value targets, people that they want to take out. They find an opportunity to do it, but they have to go through a pretty rigorous approval process in the Obama administration. And, for all the right reasons, that process is in place because we are not at war in these places. I mean, all of our systems, all of our processes, all of our laws are based on this idea that you wait for war and then you go to war and then you declare war, right? And you engage in war and you give the military a free hand to run that war. But we haven't declared war since like World War II. We don't have active war zones. I mean, we had sort of an active war zone in Afghanistan and Iraq, pretty close to one. But everything since has been in these places like Yemen or Syria, where there's civilians everywhere. You can't make sense of who's the bad guy, who's the good guy. And so you have this really complex problem that if you're the president of the United States, you're trying to make sure that you don't make the problem worse and that you know it's going to come down to you. And there's, ethical issues and human rights issues and international law issues. And you can't just say, yeah, shoot guys when you see them. And then everything comes back to you. So they had sort of ratcheted up the oversight, and it was pretty controversial. So, you can see where the military would say, okay, I got it. We'll avoid all those things, and we'll still do it.
Well, what's confusing, I think, on that, and that does describe our situation today, but in a place like Yemen, where when you had this SEAL team raid, it was followed by pretty quickly by a complaint raised by the Yemeni's government, the government that nominally controls part of Yemen, saying, We didn't approve this. Nobody told us what's going on here. But meanwhile, there are drone strikes happening as we tape this podcast almost daily in and around this mission. And that seems to be a separate thing, or the drone strikes raised to a different level, even though they can cause sensitivities in other ways. So where are we now with this situation where you have these ever-present drone strikes in places, whether it's Syria, Yemen, Somalia, that don't seem to rise to the level of a actual manned mission?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this is an issue. So I've always said, people get very excited about drones. And I was actually on a task force on drones. But it ended up, the conversation was never about drones. The conversation was about targeted killings, right, which is what you're describing. And, you could do that with a drone. You could do it with a manned aircraft like an F-16. Or you could do it with a Joint Special Operations Team, a JSOC team, right? Choose your tool, right? And now this is a great example of why people usually choose drones over JSOC teams, because the JSOC team puts a lot more people on the ground. People get killed. It makes the headlines. It makes the host nation a lot more unhappy because they feel as though they've been invaded in ways that drones don't, ironically. And so, and also we have these, and I can't speak for the particulars about Yemen or Syria or Somalia or any of these places, but in a lot of the drone strike regimes, we have agreements with the host nation, and some of the targets are their targets. So it's a completely different thing, right? It politically, mm-hmm. right? Even though the tools from the toolkit, you know, are designed to do similar things. The putting a JSOC team on the ground is supposed to be more precise because you can see things, right? But in this case, things went awry. And I'll say one more thing about that particular incident. Well, it's interesting that at the same time President Trump is saying he wants to delegate more responsibility down to the military, one of the things he said about that strike was, it wasn't my fault. They planned it before me. I just said yes. Okay, so which is it? Are you responsible or are you not responsible? Are you going to delegate down and then leave the generals hanging? Because they're not going to like that either. So they're going to have to work out responsibility, delegation, and making sure they're on the same sheet of music before they just wind the generals up and let them go.
So we are now on our second national security advisor. The first was a general, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn. Now we have H.R. McMaster. And he is active. He's still an active duty general. And he's well known for his scholarship. And he has also been very outspoken about his approach to sort of the U.S. Quote-unquote war on terrorism, especially in reference to jihadists or to the term radical Islamic terrorists. And he does not like the term and has said it, among other things, counterproductive to working with U.S. allies from the Muslim world and so forth. But that does not seem to be winning the day so far in some of the messaging from the White House. But on a broader point, you had published on, when you were a CFR fellow, you had your blog republished a transcript of McMaster's comments at a Veterans Day ceremony in Georgetown in 2014. And he talked about what he described as the warrior ethos at risk. And among other things, he mentioned, and I'll quote, he said, "The warrior ethos is at risk because fewer and fewer Americans are connected to our professional military. Separation from our society is consequential because warriors depend on respect for what they do to maintain their self-respect." And he went on in that vein. We now have a situation where the warriors are, you know, many of them are at leadership positions. They're relied on heavily, seemingly, from the president and from his still very young administration. Are we in a situation where that warrior ethos, there might be an opportunity to repair some things and for these officials, people like General McMaster, to sort of start to bridge some of those differences?
Well, first of all, H.R. McMaster is brilliant. I've known him for a number of years. That particular speech that I posted a couple years ago was incredibly popular because he's incredibly popular. He's very well respected, and he is one of the big intellects of the national security community, not just of the Army. But, you know, there was something deeper in that speech that I think can answer this question. The short answer is, sure, you know, his presence will put a Band-Aid on this issue. But the bigger issue that he talks about is that it's not just that Americans are separated from their military. It's that they don't know military things. There aren't a lot of civilians who study war. And part of it is because our academic institutions, and it's something as a professor that I have actually been sort of complaining about, we he says something to the effect of they have conflated the study of war with advocacy of war. And so they've dismantled a lot of these kinds of programs like security studies and history of war that we had during the Cold War. And so you have a couple generations of civilians in the national security structure that come from law backgrounds that actually have never taken a class on deterrence theory. They don't understand, you know, the operational art the way that I think previous generations might have. So what happens is you have, back to the military walking in the door with military advice, you have a bunch of civilians who aren't speaking this language at all. And there's a big, big disconnect. So having guys like HR, you know, he can help if he can translate that language. But it's still about, it's much deeper in American society.
He also mentioned in that speech, you know, how many Americans, for example, could name the three main Taliban organizations we're fighting in Afghanistan and Pakistan as an example of the, sort of the disconnect. We were talking about drones as well. I think one of the concerns about overuse of drones is that, you know, out of sight, out of mind, it's even further, it further disconnects you from the battlefield. So in taking the battle to the Islamic State, one of the avowed goals of the Trump administration, what would you say about the need to message this properly? I mean, it's not just about sort of successes on the battlefield, but what is the goal, I would imagine?
Well, that's probably a topic for a whole other podcast, but yeah, about counterterrorism.
We'll do a pod 3-minute version here, Janine.
No, but I mean, I think also, you know, in addition to my critique of our academic institutions not studying these things, you can critique, you know, the media, aside from places like here, where you know, the vast majority of Americans aren't hearing the news about the war. They aren't looking for it because they're not connected to the military. And so therefore, they don't have the context. And so it really, really is incumbent on the leadership to paint the right picture of the threat. I think that the threat of terrorism to the homeland has been vastly overstated. We obviously have way more murders in this country by Americans, you know, in movie theaters and schools and shopping malls than you're ever going to have. And so and just eliminating, you know, eradicating the Islamic State is a much more complex problem than people really have their head around. I mean, we thought that we had the insurgent groups in Iraq under control, but they just remorphed into ISIS. So you can get ISIS under control, and what are they going to remorph into? There's a bigger issue here that isn't just about killing.
In terms of that issue, sort of messaging and media, does it require, say, the Defense Department to get more involved in strategic communications? There's a lot of things that the State Department was doing to sort of try to counter message some of the jihadi websites that, and some of the radical websites that they were seeing. There's this whole arm of U.S. international broadcasting, the Voice of America, and so forth, that is about kind of trying to propagate good journalism and solid reporting throughout the world. But what about, is there a role in the military here that's more they could do, or is that an area to be really careful of?
Well, this is another issue where there was a point in the Bush administration where the military started to step into that role. And people thought it was an overstretch, and they were sort of out of their lane, so to speak. And that's more of a State Department thing, or you know, other agencies. And so, in this administration, the State Department has taken on a lot of the sort of counterterrorism, focusing on homegrown terrorism. And Homeland Security Department has also played that role. And so, I'm hesitant to put the military in that role or to give them that task. But I think, again, like with all this stuff, if you have an interagency cooperative framework, then everybody at least understands what the mission is and what the goal is, and that even though it may not be the military's role to set up a shop or set up some sort of a program to do that, when their leaders are out and about around the world, they know what they should be saying and that we're on a similar sheet of music.
I want to talk about another agency, civilian agency we haven't talked about yet that's been a great deal in the news as well, which is intelligence, specifically the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA. Latest reports are about what appears to be a WikiLeaks, a major WikiLeaks leak looking at CIA cyber tools. But it's also been a very controversial part of the government because of the ongoing sort of investigations into potential, you know, Russian attempts to tamper with and steer the U.S. Elections. Now you have an intelligence agency, though, that is seen as crucial in the U.S. fight against terrorism. How is it mesh, even in better days, how does it mesh with the military and with other arms of the civilian part of the government in trying to sort of maintain a credible voice?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how old the WikiLeaks stuff is. I think there's a lot of lessons that we've learned over time about this. Again, you know, war is not what war used to be, if it ever was that, what we think it is. It's totally blended in terms of the homeland and, you know, overseas, physically, and now cyberspace. We have to have, and our laws are still, for all the right reasons, based on the old-fashioned sensibility about war. And we want to be war over there and not over here. We want our police to be completely different than our military. We don't want any surveillance on American people in American homeland, and for all the right reasons. But, you know, when you have a competitor like Russia doing the kinds of things that they're doing, and even China, in some cases, doing the kinds of things they're doing in the cyber realm, I think the American taxpayers sort of expect that we got our heads around that. So how do you do it? How do you do that? You do it by trying desperately to hold the line on privacy in America. And I know from my experience in the government, they try very, very hard. They do. And checks and balances. At the same time, you have interagency coordination. So you'll have working groups where you can kind of share information where you're allowed to share and where you're not. And it's incredibly complex and it's not easy. But the answer is not to not engage in those domains.
There's the civilian intelligence agencies, and there's also a great deal of defense intel agencies as well. To what extent do they communicate on a regular basis? And I'm thinking to the reports after 9/11 about the inability to connect the dots. And that wasn't necessarily a defense civilian intelligence problem, but it still remains to be seen how much we know about the way they interact with each other.
Yeah. I mean, that was, I think the 9/11 was a big wake-up call about how stovepiped our agencies were. There has been a lot of progress in that area in terms of interagency coordination. There's the National Counterterrorism Center, which is by design an interagency center where everybody sends like secondees from all the different agencies so that they can work that issue. There's also NORTHCOM, which is a combatant command based in Colorado that has a hybrid responsibility. Well, not really a hybrid responsibility. Their focus is on protecting the homeland. So it used to be all about NORAD and the potential incoming nuclear missiles. But they also coordinate with the National Guard and the police communities and make sure that people kind of stay in their own lanes while at the same time being cognizant of what each other is doing as the threat passes over those lanes, right?
Another agency headed by a military official I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast is Homeland Security, General Kelly. He actually needed to walk back the president a little bit on some of his comments regarding the initial round of deportation orders that went out where President Trump described it as a military operation. And he said, actually, it's not a military operation. And this gets to what you were talking about in terms of the dividing line between overseas operations and domestic operations. Given the emphasis on immigration and on homeland security, do you see any concerns about this sort of mindset that there needs to be a military type of efficiency brought to bear to make this work better?
Yeah, I'm actually deeply concerned about the militarization of our police function in this country, actually. If you look at the police response in various cities around the country over the last decade, they have gotten increasingly more and more militaristic. They're driving military vehicles. They're decked out like a JSOC team. A lot of them are former military. Their language has changed. They say things like, they use military language. Like military will say, this is my AOR, my area of responsibility. A policeman should say, this is my neighborhood. I live here. They don't see it that way. They're starting to not see it as much that way. And I think that's a dangerous and slippery slope. And when you combine that with the sort of fear of terrorism that has been sort of whipped up a little bit in this country, it makes people kind of crave that kind of military efficiency. But I think we should be very careful about that.
Well, this gets to the sort of the messaging of the administration coming in, which was that the country was in a almost crisis mode and that things needed to happen and happen right away. And there's been a backlash and the country is sorting it out. In terms of, so back to the original question about the way, you know, civilian and military relations can work most effectively. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, examples of how they have worked effectively that you've seen up close or that you've studied?
Well, I mean, it comes at different levels. So those much maligned PRTs that we talked about on the ground.
Provincial reconstruction teams.
The provincial reconstruction teams in Iraq and Afghanistan. After, you know, a few years of really not knowing how to approach this, they finally did sort of get this right, where they did then hire more people in the State Department. They did hire, and they were hired under different authorities, but they were put in the field. So I'm hopeful that there's this kind of a generation of people, because, you know, who served in these war zones that are going to be coming into senior positions or, you know, around the country, whether they're academics or whether they're back in government, that have this ethos in their mind about how things should work. So that's like in the field. Back here in Washington, it goes all different ways. there are sometimes it's by region where certain regions, like in the people that work on Middle East issues in the State Department or in USAID and in DOD and in the intel community, they've been working together. These are the career types of people for, you know, because of wars. They are they know each other, right? And when there are crises, they come together and they help, you know, gin up decision-making products for the president and the or their own principles. But then in other regions where they don't know each other, it doesn't work as well. Thing is that these processes are not set. They're not formalized. They work when the individuals know each other and they have these relationships and they have sort of a history and a practice of doing it, and they don't work otherwise. And so when you have a change of administration, you really rely on the careerists that have been doing this for a time to kind of bring people along. If you fire them all, then you'll have a harder time.
We are in a country where you've had almost a generation growing up in the post 9/11 period. The country's had this sort of open-ended war on terror. There are continue to be forces deployed in the Middle East and Afghanistan, and a great deal of concern about an abiding threat, whether it's a cyber threat or an ongoing terror threat. What do you see as the administration's main goal at this point in terms of, or main challenge in terms of trying to both carry out what it sees as its number one goal of securing the homeland, while also giving people a sense that they are safe and that they are that they're not going to make things worse?
I think that's the great challenge of any administration. I think that, you know, on the one, you can go all the way to the extreme and say, you know, don't worry your pretty little head, we've got this under control. And then you get into the problem that H.R. McMaster describes, which is you've just left everything to the military and you're not cognizant of what the threat is out there. You don't understand the role of America in the world and everything else. And that's a problem. But I think that it is important not to overreact. I think that it is important to understand the data and to understand what's actually happening. We don't have the kind of threat, the homegrown threat, that other countries have. That said, if I'm the president, which I'm not, thank goodness, but if I'm the president, I wake up every day worried that it'll happen on my watch because, you know, we're just sort of lucky it hasn't happened again.
On the scale of 9/11.
Yeah, and I get that. And so I think that there is constantly a sense of pressure to lock things down more and more and more. And what the counterterrorism experts would say is that the more you do those kinds of things, the more you build barriers. I mean, I just look at the White House across the street from here, right? And how many years have you worked here? The fence gets further and further and further and further away, right? And that's sort of like a metaphor for all these kinds of things that happen. If we do those kinds of things and continue to change away our way of life to such a degree, then the enemy gets what they want, right? To the extent that they want to destroy our way of life, our Western way of life, then we can't keep doing those kinds of things. So you have to accept a little bit of risk in order to maintain the kinds of things that we hold dear. And I know that sounds a little bit cliche, but that's the greatest challenge. You have to resist the urge to militarize everything.
And on that note, we'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. Janine, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on iTunes and leave us a review. It really helps. Please note that opinions expressed on the President's Inbox are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by Kevin Lizarazzo with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick and recording engineer Dan Mudd. Special thanks to Audrey Bowler and Lauren Peterson. This is Robert McMahon. Thanks for listening. We'll see you soon on the President's Inbox.